You're listening to SBS News.
This is the final battle for the completion of the Darfur genocide. We're at Rwanda-level killing.
There's a plan, and President Trump will be the president in 28.
The first female prime minister in the history of Japan.
In terms of consequences and repercussions for Hamas, nothing is off the table right now.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Katrina Stirrett in Sydney.
And I'm Claudia Farhat in Jakarta.
A big week for diplomacy, Claudia, as leaders gathered in Malaysia for the ASEAN summit. Our political correspondent Naveen Razik talks us through the trade, security and economic challenges on the agenda. Plus, US President Donald Trump basks in the spotlight as he tours Asia, as talk of a third term resurfaces back home.
Also, is the Gaza ceasefire about to collapse? We'll have the latest on Israel's strikes on the Strip. Plus, Trump ups the pressure on Putin with new oil sanctions. Ukrainian MP Lysa Vasilenko will be joining us from Kyiv shortly.
As Southeast Asian nations grapple with hefty US-imposed tariffs, China has upgraded its free trade agreement with ASEAN members at the summit in Malaysia. Our political correspondent Naveen Razik was a fly on the wall for some of those meetings, and he joins us now having just landed in Seoul following Anthony Albanese to the next summit. Naveen, thanks for fitting us in. Let's kick off with China. Talk us through this new trade deal.
G'day guys, it's great to chat to you from what's been a very busy Asian summit season. China is ASEAN's largest trading partner, and in upgrading this free trade agreement, China was striking a contrast with the United States. US President Donald Trump did spend around 24 hours or so in Kuala Lumpur. He oversaw the Thailand-Cambodia peace deal. He gave a few tariff exemptions away, but those baseline tariff rates on the Southeast Asian nations still remain very hard. And the fact that the bloc's members are among the hardest hit by tariffs as well. So China taking the opportunity to move in, try and prove itself that it is the more reliable trading partner, and also give a sly dig at the US as well, accusing major powers of economic bullying in the region.
Now, if you're in the room for the sit-down between Premier Li Qiang and Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, what was discussed there?
Well, the tone of that meeting, in front of the cameras at least, seemed fairly cordial. China, in particular, was playing up the strength of the relationship with Australia. The Premier Li Qiang, in particular, praising Anthony Albanese's visit a few months ago to Beijing, where the Prime Minister spent, you know, close to a week, visited the Great Wall of China, visited a panda centre as well. Australia mostly struck a similar tone, but there was also some veiled diplomatic language about respecting the rules of the international order. Now, just last week, Australia accused Beijing of unsafe and unprofessional behaviour after a Chinese fighter jet released flares twice, you know, a short distance away from a Australian surveillance plane conducting routine patrols in the South China Sea. That ignited a war of words, Beijing accusing Canberra of inflammatory propaganda. Now, once the cameras were taken out of that room, SBS News understands the Prime Minister put forward Australia's position on that particular incident. He also raised the case of detained Australian Dr. Yang Hengjun, who was given a suspended death sentence on espionage charges he denies.
You're now in South Korea for APEC, where Xi Jinping and Donald Trump are going to meet. What are you thinking is going to come from that one?
Well, yes, Donald Trump has very much been moving the headlines with him as he goes across from Kuala Lumpur, then to Japan, now touching down in South Korea. He effectively is treating this trip as some sort of big diplomatic victory lap. And the prize, the ultimate prize, is that sit down with Xi Jinping and coming out with a deal that he can sell to the American people. China will also be looking to do the same. We know the groundwork around negotiations, around averting, you know, an escalation to this trade war was taking place in Kuala Lumpur. Negotiations between economic officials, Scott Bessent, saying that Trump's promised 100% tariffs on Chinese goods that were due to come in at the end of the month have effectively been averted. So some deal may be signed. It's likely critical mineral access could be part of that as well. So a deal could be signed. The ownership of TikTok could be part of that as well. There's also an increased focus on China's stronghold on the production of critical minerals too. Ultimately, one thing can probably be guaranteed, which is whatever the outcome of tomorrow's meeting, both China and the US will be selling it as a win.
Naveen Razik, our political correspondent, joining us from Seoul. Donald Trump has imposed sanctions on Russia's two biggest oil companies, something that is likely, in the long run at least, to impact their ability to fund its war machine. The sanctions mean anyone buying Russian oil risk losing access to the dollar-based financial system, a real stick being meted on Putin now, which could have serious consequences for India and China, now the biggest buyers of Russian oil by far.
And the impact has been swift. Within hours, the sanctions triggered a 6% rise in oil prices, and reports were emerging of an immediate pause of Russian oil deliveries to the biggest refineries in India and to China's biggest state-owned companies as well. The question is whether this was going to have enough of an impact in the short term to help Ukraine weather the progress by Russian troops around key cities like Pokrovsk. And to help us answer that question, we've got Ukrainian MP Lysa Vasilenko joining us now from Kyiv. Lysa, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning.
Firstly, Lysa, can we ask you, what is the current situation in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk, these two crucial cities on the front line that Russia has been desperate to take and which Moscow says are now about to fall?
There's been a lot of back and forth around these two cities for an extremely long time now. When Russia says it's about to fall, it's part of the war tactics by demoralizing the Ukrainian side, the Ukrainian troops, also the civilian population in those various cities and around them. They are hoping to get the upper hand on the military ground. At the same time, our troops have also had a lot of back and forth. It just depends at what time in the war we're talking about. But you are absolutely correct in saying that these are crucial cities for Ukraine's defense, but also every city on Ukrainian territory is crucial for us because it has Ukrainians living there, and they have their homes there, they have their families, they have their wish to live under the Ukrainian flag, and this is what our army, our military is defending.
And Lysa, President Zelensky didn't get the Tomahawk missiles he wanted, but the sanctions seem like a rather better result, don't they?
The sanctions are a good result. Well, everything today that is used to hit Russia's economy, to impact its ability to mass produce weapons, to have it continuously bombard Ukraine with missiles and drones, and also follow through with its attacks on the ground on the Ukrainian territories, every single thing like that that weakens Russia is a bonus. It helps Ukraine. It helps Ukraine stand. It helps us win this war. It helps us survive. However, there's this phrase going around in Ukraine that everything that is being done, it's always too little too late. The feeling, it's almost like we are getting given in terms of weapons, military defense, in terms of sanctions, just enough for us to keep standing, and definitely not enough for us to win the war and push back on Russia once and for all. And that's the frustration of the Ukrainian people, that we have to be grateful because we are still getting what is needed for us to stay alive. But the frustration, especially on the front lines, is that it's never enough to really have that breakthrough and to push back on the Russian troops to get them out of Ukrainian territory beyond the border and put an end to the aggression.
Yeah, so given those frustrations, how are you feeling about these oil sanctions? Do you think that they could have enough of an impact quickly enough?
All of the sanctions do work. So rest assured about that. It's usually Russian propaganda that tries to spread the message that, look, sanctions, they're too slow, they don't really affect anyone in Russia. Ask people on the street, have their lives become any worse? Well, look, the sanctions do work. Otherwise, Russia wouldn't even be commenting on the sanctions. We know that there is an impact because there's millions of Russians who have left the country, who simply do not want to live, yes, under such a political authoritarian regime, but also because life has become increasingly difficult. And it's not just people from Moscow and St. Petersburg, it's people from smaller towns all across that country. We know that the Russian war machine is getting stalled every time the sanctions get introduced. It would have been much, much easier for Russia to advance on Ukrainian territory if there had been no sanctions. So in terms of these oil sanctions, we were hoping they would come at a much earlier stage. We were hoping that they would be accompanied by secondary sanctions as well, that there would be a unanimous package on also the Russian shadow fleet, through which Russian oil gets sold, not directly, but through the black and grey market in the world. But okay, that's great as well. It's definitely going to affect Russia's economy. It's definitely going to affect their ability to mass produce weapons. And this is the key, that they have that capacity to hit Ukrainians with thousands of drones per night, in addition to missiles, which is called combined attacks, because they have the money to mass produce the weapons.
Yeah, and Russia has continued its onslaught on energy and civilian targets around the country ahead of winter, despite these sanctions, a tactic it has relied on to try and break the Ukrainian will to wage this war. What is life like in Kyiv and elsewhere now, Lisa?
We are entering a very difficult winter. It's already very cold. The heating hasn't been switched on in Ukraine. There's continuous power cuts in big cities, including in Kyiv, which is the capital of Ukraine. Power cuts, you have to understand, it's not just a kind of a Western world luxury that people are suddenly deprived of, that they don't have the light, they can't put on the lights after it gets dark. Although that too, you have to understand that depriving people in big cities of electricity is a direct threat to their physical safety and security. Let's imagine a situation. You're an old person in your, I don't know, 70s, 80s, or you're a mom with a very young child, or you're a person with a disability. It's the middle of the night, 1 a.m., the air raid alarm goes off. There's a power cut. The elevator isn't working. How are you going to get down to the bomb shelter? You can't. You don't get down to the bomb shelter. All you can do is just pray that you are alive in the morning and that the Shahed drones, which Russia is launching at this very moment, will not hit your building and that it will be the building next to you. And then in the morning, you either wake up and you're grateful, or your body is found among all the rubble that is left after missiles and Shaheds hit Ukrainian civilian buildings and residential blocks.
Thank you so much for making the time to speak to us, Lisa, during a very difficult time for Kyiv and all of Ukraine.
Thank you.
On behalf of our country, I want to just let you know, anytime you have any question, any doubt, anything you want, any favors you need, anything I can do to help Japan, we will be there.
That was US President Donald Trump telling the new Japanese Prime Minister Sane Takaichi they were the next level allies. Takaichi, for her part, appeared to welcome President Trump with open arms, even going as far as to say she would nominate Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize, an approach Takaichi seems to have picked up on what many leaders are doing to curry favour with Trump, and that is to flatter and praise, essentially. But the dynamic went both ways, with the US president also laying compliments on Japan's new PM, saying she'd be, quote, one of the great prime ministers, making reference to what he'd heard from the late Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, golfing partner and friend of President Trump. Takaichi even gifted Trump a putter owned by the assassinated PM Abe. And in a particularly astute show of soft diplomacy, she threw in a gold golf ball too.
And Shinzo Abe was Takaichi's mentor, so that connection combined with all her flattery seemed to be a winning combo, Kat. Another reason for them to hit it off, I guess, is that Takaichi is a hardline conservative. She's just created a minister for immigration, which is something Japan has never had before, in response to rising anti-foreigner sentiment. So they're singing from the same songbook there too. And ahead of Trump's visit, Takaichi promised to increase Japan's defense spending to 2% of GDP, a whole 2 years ahead of schedule. So once again, aligning with Donald Trump. There were a couple of deals they got signed in between the love fest as well. There was a new rare earth minerals agreement, and another one that seems to be aimed at countering China's dominance in the market. There was a document heralding a new, quote, golden age of US-Japan relations, and also an investment package that's going to see Japan buy something like $830 billion worth of goods from the US.
Yeah, Takaichi will have to tread carefully, though, when it comes to Japan's relationship with the US. China has already come out to urge Japan to respect the security concerns of their neighbours after the meeting with Trump. And it's not the only victory Trump is lauding from his trip to Asia. He shone a temporary media spotlight on the ASEAN summit in Malaysia, where he stopped to take the credit for a peace deal signed between Thailand and Cambodia in Kuala Lumpur, giving the longest speech at the ceremony, detailing how he got involved in the border conflict while visiting his golf course in Scotland in July, recalling comments he made about how saving people and countries was much more important than a round of golf.
Yes, much more important. The read on this one, in the region at least, Kat, is that neither Thailand or Cambodia really wanted to do this deal, but particularly Thailand, but they were more or less forced into it by Donald Trump, who threatened to put their trade talks with the US at risk if they didn't. And at one point there was even reporting that Trump had made his entire attendance at the ASEAN summit conditional on them agreeing to this public peace ceremony. Also, he could sort of chalk up another win in that column. Now that it's signed, though, Thailand is really talking down how far this deal actually goes. The foreign minister refused to call it a peace agreement. He says it's instead a joint declaration and a pathway to peace. And to be fair, it doesn't really have much substance. Yes, they've agreed to remove heavy weaponry from the border and release 18 Cambodian soldiers, but it doesn't actually address any of the territorial disputes at the heart of this conflict. So really hard to call it a genuine peace deal.
One theory on how you might try to serve a third term is that you could run as the vice president.
Yeah, I'd be allowed to do that.
Is it the White House or the White House Counsel's or your legal position?
No, you'd be allowed to do that, but I wouldn't. I wouldn't do that. I think it's too cute. Yeah, I would rule that out because it's too cute. I think the people wouldn't like that. It's too cute. It's not. It wouldn't be right. Am I not ruling it out? I mean, you'll have to tell me. All I can tell you is that we have a great group of people, which they don't.
Well, it's certainly not the first time we've heard US President Donald Trump flirt with the idea of a third term, a move prohibited under the 22nd Amendment of the US Constitution. He certainly hasn't shied away from theatrics around Trump 2028, with his supporters often donning hats at rallies, but he did dismiss suggestions the vice presidency could be his pathway, a move that is also not viable under the 12th Amendment, which clarifies that any person ineligible for president cannot run for vice president.
Yeah, we just heard reporters in an exchange with the president on board Air Force One. And while Trump said he wouldn't run for vice president in 2028, suggesting it would upset people, he also refused to rule out a third term. And he told reporters that he hadn't thought about whether he'd be willing to fight in court over the legality of a presidential bid. The US House Speaker Mike Johnson has now come out to say he's spoken with Trump about this and that Trump's aware there isn't actually enough time to amend the Constitution to allow for a third term. But we have seen Trump moot unpalatable things in the past to get people used to them, Kat. And critics are also pointing to the total destruction of the White House's East Wing and the construction of a $450 million ballroom. Not exactly something they say people would normally do for the next president.
Yeah, the demolition of the East Wing has really struck a nerve for many in the US, and not in a good way. Trump insisting private donors will pick up the check. His own supporters are underplaying the move, saying nearly all presidents make renovations to the White House, but no president has ever gone as far as this. And a lot of commentary suggests the president's move goes against the very grain of what the White House symbolises, designed as a humble antithesis to the gilded glory of palaces like Versailles.
Yeah, and it seems the president's boldness isn't limited to his interior decoration. Trump is now going as far as to say he will be the one to approve the $230 million government payout He claims he's entitled to for his legal costs as a result of Justice Department investigations into his conduct, including the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago and the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. He told reporters earlier this week that any decision on the payout would have to go across his desk, seeming to point out the absurdity of the situation when he said, "I'm suing myself."
Are you asking them to pay you compensation for the federal investigations that happened to you? And how much are you asking
Well,
for?
I guess they probably owe me a lot of money for that. Probably, yeah, that's true. That's very interesting. No, I get no salary. I gave up my salary. It's a good salary. But as far as all of the litigation and everything that's been involved, yeah, they probably owe me a lot of money. But if I get money from our country, I'll do something nice with it, like give it to charity or give it to the White House while we restore the White House.
So he'd effectively be splitting himself in three with that move as both the president, claimant and defendant. And it certainly doesn't bode well for transparency, with many of Trump's allies now actually occupying the positions in the very department responsible for evaluating claims to seek damages from the government. But if it's all not dramatic enough already, he's imposing retaliatory tariffs for an unusual reason, Claudia.
Yeah, Canada is on the receiving end of Trump's ire once again, Kat, this time for an ad Ontario aired during the Baseball World Series. The ad used the words of former President Ronald Reagan to criticize tariffs, prompting Trump to take to Truth Social and respond with an angry post calling for the ad to be taken down immediately and describing it as fraud. He's now threatened to increase the tariffs on Canada by 10% on top of the already 35% tariff they've been hit with. So expensive ad, Kat.
Yeah, the tariff wars continue. That was some of the aftermath of a new round of Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip, ordered by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu late on Tuesday evening, accusing Hamas of ceasefire violations by failing to return the bodies of the dead hostages and accusing its fighters of firing on Israeli soldiers earlier on Tuesday. Hamas says it had no connection to those attacks and is committed to the ceasefire. So far, Gaza's civil defence says at least 33 Palestinians have been killed in the new strikes.
So far, the US is trying to play this one down. Vice President J.D. Vance basically saying there's nothing to see here. He told reporters in Washington that the deal is holding. That doesn't mean there aren't going to be little skirmishes here and there, but we already knew that the US was incredibly anxious about the deal breaking down. And this wasn't one skirmish or one strike. There were hits reported in both the north and the south of the strip. Right now, the deal seems to be back on track, but I think we've just seen how quickly that can change.
Yeah, and it wasn't the only challenge this week. Israel said it's going to determine which countries are allowed to contribute troops to a potential peacekeeping force for the Strip, saying it would not allow Turkish forces to participate. We know the Trump administration had been discussing those plans with Ankara, so that may throw a spanner in the works. And the so-called yellow line that marks the point Israeli troops have withdrawn to now seems to be evolving from a marking on a map to an actual physical barrier. So this week, the IDF started installing yellow concrete blocks roughly every 200 metres to mark the line. There's already been reports civilians have been shot for just approaching it, even when there hasn't been a yellow block there marking it.
Yeah, and the BBC's reporting that in some cases, these yellow blocks have been placed more than 500 metres deeper into Gaza than the line that was actually agreed on the map. This is a line that's basically splitting the strip right down the middle. And we're now seeing Israel reinforce its military outposts right along it. So it's causing a lot of speculation inside Israel that this could become some sort of new permanent barrier dividing the Gaza Strip. Under Trump's peace plan, Israeli forces are supposed to withdraw in three phases until they eventually only occupy a sort of buffer zone right along the border. But the more this line becomes built up, the harder it's going to be to unbuild it. It's still very early days, Kat, but it has already drawn comparisons to other barriers and outposts that were put up in the West Bank temporarily, only to never be taken down. So I think there's going to be a lot of eyes on this line going forward.
Yeah, the US is trying to keep the peace deal together. We've seen the high-level trips delegations travelling to Israel continue through this week. Here's US Secretary of State Marco Rubio.
This is something very difficult, but worth doing. It'll be historic if it can be pulled off, and we're committed to ensuring that every one of these points is lived up to. But it's not going to be an easy ride. There are going to be bumps along the road, but we have to make it work. There is no other alternative.
And it looks like there's more to come, Claudia. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dan Kane, is now on his way too.
Yeah, Kat, last week we said Donald Trump wasn't going to be able to send one of his top officials every time the ceasefire looked to be in doubt, but perhaps we spoke a little too soon because that's exactly what he now seems to be doing.
Yeah, before Rubio and Kane, just in the 2 weeks since the ceasefire came into effect, we've seen Donald Trump himself, his Vice President J.D. Vance, his son-in-law Jared Kushner and his special envoy Steve Witkoff all travel to Tel Aviv. The Israeli press is having a bit of fun with it, saying the Americans are now babysitting Netanyahu. The Israeli PM denies that's what's going on. But if you look at this string of visits, he's basically been under constant American supervision since the ceasefire began.
Yeah, Trump's team has been worried since the start, really, that Netanyahu or his far-right coalition allies might try to undermine the deal. And it certainly looks like that's what they're trying to do, because during J.D. Vance's visit late last week, those far-right allies managed to get the Knesset to give preliminary approval to a plan to annex the occupied West Bank in full. J.D. Vance called it an insult and a very stupid political stunt. Donald Trump has said it's just never going to happen because he's given Arab states his word that it won't. Netanyahu has since had the bill suspended, but we know that the far right and their supporters are furious with him for signing the ceasefire deal. They see the West Bank as their way of getting some sort of revenge for that. And settler violence in the West Bank has been surging ever since this deal was done. The Times of Israel reported this week that what it described as Jewish extremists had been boasting online about dozens of Palestinian cars and homes being burnt in a spate of attacks this month.
And time for some other stories making headlines this week. Sudan's army has retreated from El Fasher and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces took control of the city in Darfur on Sunday. The UN has issued a stark warning over reports of atrocities committed against the more than 250,000 citizens now under RSF control, with aid groups reporting chaotic scenes, including mass killings.
El Fasher was the army's last remaining stronghold in the western Darfur region, and now that it's under RSF control, there's real concern that the country could be split geographically, which could also lead to an escalation of conflict in other parts of Sudan.
After a four-decade-long insurgency resulting in an estimated 50,000 deaths, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, has announced it's withdrawing its remaining fighters from Turkey to northern Iraq. The group signed a peace deal with the Turkish government back in May, agreeing to disarm and disband.
The PKK says the decision was approved by jailed leader Abdullah Öcalan, who issued an unexpected call for the group to lay down its arms back in February. The group's now calling for legal protections from the Turkish state and for Ankara to facilitate their transition into democratic politics.
Argentina's Javier Milei has secured a decisive win in the country's midterm elections. The US president offered a $60 billion bailout to the country on condition of Milei's election win to rescue Argentina's dollar reserves, which took a massive hit after Milei's cryptocurrency blunder and family corruption allegations. Trump's move has been seen by many as interference in the election, which witnessed the lowest voter turnout since 1983, despite compulsory voting.
Milei's La Libertad Avanza won nearly 41% of the vote, these gains making it much easier for Milei to push ahead with his political agenda of spending cuts and free market reforms. But while the unexpectedly good result gives him new momentum, he still doesn't have a majority, so he'll have to rely on getting other parties on board, which will mean a change in his pretty virulent rhetoric, something analysts say they've started to observe already. And the Ivory Coast's Alassane Ouattara has secured a fourth term as president with a resounding 89.7% of the vote. Just so happens that his main opponents were also deemed ineligible to run. Ouattara is now 83 and says he's going to use his fourth term to pass the torch to a new generation, although he has no clear successor. And someone who doesn't seem to be thinking about succession plans, the world's oldest president, Paul Biya. At 92, he's just secured his eighth consecutive term in Cameroon, now with a mandate to rule until he is 99 years old. Deadly protests have broken out in Cameroon's largest city. Demonstrators say the result was rigged by Biya's allies. All makes Donald Trump's third-term ambitions seem a little bit mundane, Kat.
What's so great about Caesar? Yeah. Brutus is just as cute as Caesar. Okay, Brutus is just as smart as Caesar. People totally like Brutus just as much as they like Caesar. And when did it become okay for one person to be the boss of everybody, huh? Because that's not what Rome is about. We should totally just stab Caesar!
Gretchen Wieners freaking out there in the 2004 classic Mean Girls, still one of my favourites, Kat. And I imagine a few students at nine Brisbane high schools would have had similar Caesar-centred meltdowns this week.
Oh, thoughts and prayers to all the Year 12 ancient history classes who found out 2 days before their final exams that their teachers had accidentally been teaching them about the wrong Caesar all year. As a former ancient history student from many years ago, this one gives me chills. They were meant to be studying Julius Caesar, the OG, if you will, but instead spent all year learning about his nephew Augustus. The nine schools then had to file a mass illness and misadventure application so the kids could get special consideration when they had to sit the exam on Wednesday.
Queensland's Curriculum and Assessment Authority did a bit of tutting, putting out a statement saying schools are notified of the topic for the ancient history external exam more than 12 months in advance. Yikes. More than a few hours those students will never get back, I suppose, Kat. But if you look on the bright side, I guess they'll do okay at pub trivia nights in the future.
Yeah, I mean, you know what they say, why only learn about one ancient Roman ruler when you can learn about both?
It's a famous saying, yeah.
And that's The World This Week. If you're enjoying the pod, be sure to like and subscribe. New episodes drop every Thursday.
And if you're not enjoying the pod, our producers' names are Nick Ludlam, Ali Cheevers and Billy Dallenberg. Just kidding, of course. Big thanks to the team. Kat, I hear you're leaving me once again for a few weeks. Like Donald Trump, off to Japan.
What can I say? I just needed to be on the same continent as you and Trump, Claudia. I'll drop in with some matcha for you.
See if you can bring one of Shinzo Abe's golf clubs with you too.
I'll try my best.